Our next case this morning is case number 094056, United States versus Alexander Vasquez. Ms. Westover.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Blair Westover, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Mr. Alexander Vasquez. Your Honor, I think the facts and procedure underlying what occurred in the district court is pretty well briefed. So what I'd like to address most of my time, spend most of my time on today in lieu of any questions, is Mr. Vasquez's contention that the MCC recordings between his co-defendant, Mr. Perez, and the defense witness, Ms. Perez, the husband and wife, that those recordings were erroneously admitted. Now, ostensibly, the district court admitted these recordings for two separate purposes. One is establishing, or attempting to establish at least, some sort of inconsistency between Ms. Perez's testimony during defense case in chief. And the second reason was to attempt to establish some sort of motivation on the part of Ms. Perez to offer testimony to the benefit of the defense. As to the inconsistency, obviously it's the defense position that there was, in fact, no inconsistency between Ms. Perez's testimony and the MCC recordings, and I don't really think that the government's briefs have established one. I think it's pretty clear on the face of the recordings that what Ms. Perez is discussing is not any statement about what actually occurred on August 5th, the day the defendant was arrested, but rather her opinion of what she thought the strength of the government's case would be based on the knowledge that she had at that time. Whereas in her testimony, what she was saying was she was talking about the events that actually occurred on August 5th. I understand that an inconsistency doesn't necessarily have to be two exact opposite statements, but I think there has to be some sort of discrepancy there. And I really don't see where the discrepancy would come from.
As I understand the theory, it's that the inconsistency comes from essentially what was not said in this conversation, because it was a conversation about the sort of defense that Mr. Vasquez had and her husband had in this case, which is to say that they were just sort of innocent bystanders and didn't know about the drug money in the secret compartment in the car. She didn't say anything about the story she told at trial, which was that she asked the defendant, Vasquez, to take the car to pick up her husband because his car was parked in the garage and inaccessible as a result. And there would have been some expectation that she would mention that when she was having this jailhouse conversation over the phone with her husband about the nature of the government's case and the nature of the defense that each of them had. That's how I understand it anyway. So maybe you could address that.
Right. I would say in response to that, first, if that was the argument, then I think that what needed to happen is they should have asked her, did you ever talk to your husband? Did you ever say this to your husband? I don't think they can get in every statement she ever made for the purpose of showing that a statement wasn't made.
The statements that her husband made to her about what, for example, Mr. Brindley had said supposedly to Mr. Vasquez about pleading guilty.
Those statements obviously couldn't be a prior and consistent statement of
right.
Mrs. Perez.
But they all came in as part of this, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think the important part here, and this is what I really want to stress today, is they all came in for their truth. And the defendants, you know, whatever we want to say about prior and consistent statements, the government really only defended one section of the recordings as prior and consistent statements. The rest of it had to be admitted, I think, under the theory that it went to establish Ms. Perez's motivation. Mr. Vasquez objects that that would be hearsay. Hearsay, of course, has two parts, out-of-court statement. Obviously, these recordings are out-of-court statements. Two, offered for the truth of the matter asserted. The problem for the government is that every single one of these recordings that didn't go to inconsistency was offered for the truth of the matter asserted.
Was it argued that way?
I think yes. I mean, I think it was certainly argued for both points, but the government did say during its closing argument that Mrs. Perez was honest. And even if it wasn't argued that way, well, it's the honesty. I would say, and I don't know that honest is different from truthful or in this case. And even if it wasn't argued that way, the default position is that juries are supposed to take things for their truth, I think, unless we tell them not to.
And there wasn't any limiting instruction on this evidence given?
Not on the motivation. And the defense could not have asked for a limiting instruction because the district court ruled three times that this evidence was coming in explicitly for its truth.
Well, that was a mistake, but you could have asked for the instruction. You might have been turned down, but you could have asked for it.
I think that regardless, I agree with you. It might have been better to say, we know that you've already said it's coming in for its truth, but can we have an instruction that says it's not coming in for its truth anyway? That might have been better practice.
There's a way to do it.
Well, we could have done it a little less sarcastically than that, too, I suppose. But I think...
And propose the instruction and have it rejected.
Right. But I think that regardless of whether or not we ask for the instruction, there's no way of reading this record that doesn't say that we amply preserve the issue, I think. And I just...
What about harmlessness?
Thank you. I think the point that I also want to make today is that the harmless... The harm, the true prejudice from this came from the fact, at least largely, that it was admitted for its truth. I mean, you had statements in there, including comments from Mrs. Perez saying that that the trial counsel thought that everyone was going to lose. And in fact, the prosecution, that's one of the questions they asked her about. They asked her, didn't trial counsel say everyone's going to lose? I don't understand how that could possibly go to Ms. Perez's bias. And I don't understand how it could possibly establish an inconsistency. You know, if they didn't want the jury to consider that for its truth, why was that the question that was asked about? Why didn't they ask Ms. Perez, are you biased? The question was, did Mr. Brindley tell you everyone is going to lose? And I think that's a horribly prejudicial statement to come in.
We've had prior cases, for example, and I think it's pretty well established that if the government offers a withdrawn guilty plea, you basically get a mistrial.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly an error. How different is this from those kinds of cases?
You know, I think
two points. The defense counsel expressed the view that his client should plead guilty, mm-hmm. and that he expressed the view everyone's going to lose, whether he did or not.
Right.
That's what the jury heard, right?
Right. Well, I think the first thing I want to say is that whether he did or not, that was admitted for its truth. So the jury could take it for its truth. So the jury could have assumed that not only that Mr. Brindley said that, but that Mr. Brindley was right that everyone was going to lose. And secondly, to answer your question, I don't think it's different other than that there's an explicit rule saying don't enter the withdrawn pleas. I think in terms of the prejudice, that's really the only difference. This might be worse because you can sometimes explain away a previous plea. It's difficult to explain away a defense attorney telling their client to plead guilty. The only real conclusion you could draw based on that if you're the jury is that either the defense attorney believed his client was guilty or that he believed the evidence was sufficient that his client was going to be convicted. And I think that that's an incredibly, incredibly prejudicial thing to put before the jury. And I also want to point out that there was no great attempt in this case to sort of figure out what was true. Let's say that there's some of these statements that the court wants to say establish an inconsistency. Or let's say that there's some statement that maybe somehow gets in for its truth, though I don't think that's true. There was no real attempt to narrow down to try to figure out exactly what that inconsistency was or what statement comes in. A huge swath of recordings, all of which were very prejudicial, were entered into evidence for the purposes of establishing an inconsistency that I think is A, difficult to articulate, but B, if it occurs in such a small portion.
Ms. Westover, though, part of the problem, if I recall correctly, it was the defense that invoked Rule 106 to say if you're going to put in the parts the government wants, then we want all of them in.
Sure, and I'm glad that you brought that up. Just so that you're clear when you reviewing the briefs, nothing that we addressed, none of the quotes that we addressed in our brief, outside of the facts section, but none of the quotes that we addressed in our harmless error section were part of that 1006. The only stuff that the government didn't originally ask for were sort of the angry comments that Ms. Perez made about Mr. Brindley, his office, his employees, and we wanted those in predominantly to establish that Ms. Perez was not a great friend of ours in terms of...
That was apparent.
Yes. But the everything that we talked about in our harmless error section, that was asked for by the government. The government, it actually, I think it's on page... It's 116 of the transcript. I forget which it is in the defendant's supplement, but where they go through in the transcript each of the sections where they asked for it. You can see that for yourselves. The other thing, so before I move, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so.
If you want to reserve, that's fine.
I would like to reserve the rest of it. Thank you so much.
Mr. Lee.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Lee. The District Court in this case did not abuse its discretion in allowing the government to present the MCC recordings between Mr. Perez and Mrs. Perez in this rebuttal case after discovering that these recordings contain significant evidence of Mrs. Perez's bias and incentive to lie on behalf of the defendant. Those calls established that there were discussions beginning about a month before trial in which Mr. Perez and Mrs. Perez were considering cooperating in some way with the defendant's counsel to allow some strategy to proceed, which would result in Mr. Perez's conviction and Mr. Vasquez's acquittal. Those discussions continued over the next few weeks and developed. In the first call, clearly there was a hostility expressed by Mrs. Perez about defense counsel. But the calls then went over time and showed that there were discussions about that at least Mrs. Perez had the understanding, whether correct or not, that the defendant's counsel would make certain motions on behalf of her husband at sentencing. This all created the incentive for her to lie, all of which was not brought out during the initial testimony of Mrs. Perez and was fully appropriate for further examination in the government's rebuttal case. That was one of the reasons why the district court allowed that evidence in. It was not allowed for the truth of the matters ultimately being asserted by Marina Perez.
Well, that's what the judge thought.
He said it went in for the truth of her bias. It was more a point of going to that, not necessarily, and he did distinguish that whether or not the meetings that she was referring to actually happened, that was not something that was going to ultimately be proved, and that was not something the government argued for. The focus was on whether
argued
Mrs.
for
Perez
it or not. We've got the judge saying repeatedly, these are going in not as prior inconsistent statements, but they're going in for the truth of the matters asserted. It's all hearsay, right?
Well, he said both. They came in, all the recordings came in for bias and incentive to lie. They also came in partially, parts of them came in for prior inconsistent statements.
Did the judge ever give any limiting instruction about the use of prior inconsistent statements while this evidence was coming in?
He gave it during the jury instructions.
But not tied specifically to this evidence at the time it was coming in?
I don't believe so, no.
Did you all ask for that?
No. I don't believe we did. Again, it was the government's position that we were not trying to use these recordings to prove the truth of the matters being asserted, but to show that Mrs. Perez had a biased incentive to lie, which the jury could consider and which the jury could use to conclude that her testimony was not credible. To the extent there is a hearsay issue, Federal Evidence 8033 does provide an exception for statements of a declarant's then-existing state of mind, including a declarant's intent, plan, or motive. So
was
to the extent
was that ever discussed before the district court?
No, we did not discuss that rule in particular.
Okay. Do you want to try to save it on that basis now?
I think that, again, the core issue is that we were not trying to prove the truth of whether or not Mrs. Perez had certain meetings or not, just to go to what her understanding was. That was the core issue in terms of why the government sought to introduce the MCC recordings.
Yeah, but then you need a limiting instruction to the jury about that so that it doesn't misconstrue the evidence.
And it wouldn't hurt to tell the district judge that that's why you're offering it and why you think it takes care of the hearsay problem.
We did not bring Rule 8033 during the discussions about those recordings. In any event, there was no harm. The admission of the recordings was harmless error, given.
How can it be harmless to tell the jury the defendant's lawyer thinks he's guilty and told him to plead guilty? How can that be harmless?
The defendant's lawyer. What Mr. Perez said in the recordings is that the defendant's lawyer was telling the co-defendant, Joel Perez, to plead guilty. Which is what he.
I understood him to be saying. Okay, can you direct me to that? Because perhaps I misunderstood it.
Yes.
But he certainly was saying everybody was
going
to be.
Everybody
was going to go down, and that. So where are we in the record?
In the first call, the August 1st call.
What are you looking at? Go ahead.
The August 1st call in the page 5 of the supplemental appendix. There was a discussion from Marina Perez about how it's better to save this guy and throw him down. The inference being that it's better to go ahead with a strategy which would result in Perez's conviction and allow for Vasquez to be acquitted.
Okay. I thought Perez told his wife that Brindley had, that Vasquez had told him that Brindley told him he ought to plead guilty. Did I misunderstand that?
Just to be clear,
three layers of hearsay.
Yes, and again, this is why we weren't trying to prove the truth of those ultimate matters, but again, going to her bias and saying to lie.
But the jury didn't hear it that way, and it wasn't limited in that way before the jury. And then the August 5th phone call, Marina Perez says that Vasquez's attorney is saying that everybody is going to lose. It wasn't limited to her husband.
Well, again, that was an opinion. That was an opinion of.
It was a statement attributed to the defendant's lawyer. Not an opinion.
Yes. Nonetheless, the core of the argument was that this all went to her incentive to lie.
I understand that's your theory, but for a jury to hear that the very man who is asking them to find a reasonable doubt, supposedly, whether true or not, but supposedly earlier said everybody's going down, doesn't that totally destroy his credibility in front of the jury?
There is a 403 aspect to that.
Yeah.
And that is why and that is an issue that the government considered. And that is why, before we proceeded with the case after discovering these calls, we asked the district court to have the defendant make the defendant aware of this possible conflict and to waive that conflict. The defendant waived that conflict of interest on 2 days.
How's it a conflict? I mean, okay. Well, there's the question about whether the defense attorney could come in and testify and all that kind of stuff. But how does that solve the problem here? Even if by that point Brindley had been replaced by a new counsel, for a jury to hear the defense counsel said everybody's going down and the defendant ought to plead guilty, I really struggle with that.
Well, if the defendant had not waived the conflict at that point, it's unclear whether the trial could have proceeded. There may have been an issue in terms of how the trial could have proceeded at that particular point.
Sure, but a conflicts waiver doesn't waive hearsay objections.
Or 403.
Right. And that's what we're here talking about.
Right. So. And the district court was aware of a 403 problem, or a 403 concern here. When these tapes were first introduced, the district court acknowledged that there was a potential 403 problem, explicitly stating that there was a 403 aspect to the evidence. The district court thus told the government to approach the issue, quote, with an abundance of caution, and told the government to be careful in this distillation process. And that's why we did present, came back the next day, with proposed redactions for the calls. Now, the defendant objected to the calls coming in their entirety, but the defendant did not propose any narrower redactions and did ask for the entire calls to be played.
I interrupted you when you were talking about harmlessness.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you want to go back to that?
Yes. In terms of harmless error, there are two categories of evidence. Given the extreme evidence of the evidence of extreme evasive measures by the defendant, that was something that the jury could well conclude, could use to base its conclusion that the defendant was guilty. The defendant, when confronted by police, he fled by ramming into two police cars, by driving headlong at an armed law enforcement agent, drove headlong into oncoming traffic, and continued to try to evade law enforcement both by car and by foot. Beyond that, Mrs. Perez's testimony did not hold up when fit together with the other evidence in the case, especially when put with the additional recordings that were introduced in the rebuttal case. Mrs. Perez's testimony was that her husband, Joel Perez, left the defendant's house at about 4 o'clock to go to Arlington Heights, and that someone picked him up to take him to Arlington Heights where she did not know this, but a drug deal was going to take place. And her testimony was that Alexander Vasquez left shortly thereafter to go pick up her husband, and that this happened totally by accident because she was supposed to go but did not. This testimony does not fit with undisputed evidence that came in during trial. The evidence showed that Carlos Cruz, the cooperating defendant in this case, did not pick up Joel Perez in Chicago to take him to the drug deal until about an hour later. And this was established by recorded conversations between Carlos Cruz and the government's confidential source, in which he was saying that he was on his way to pick up his cousin, meaning Joel Perez, and that he needed directions to get from Irving Park in Harlem to get to Arlington Heights for the drug deal. That establishes that Joel Perez did not leave for the drug deal until about an hour after Mrs. Perez's testimony puts them leaving. Beyond that, it also shows that the only way to reconcile Mrs. Perez's testimony with those contemporaneous recordings and telephone evidence is to assume that Alexander Vasquez left for the drug deal with the money needed to complete the drug deal about an hour before Joel Perez himself leaves for the drug deal. That illogical conclusion was something the jury could well conclude was implausible and reject, even without considering the MCC recordings. To the extent that parts of the recordings came in as prior inconsistent statements, again, Judge Sykes, you were correct in terms of the government's theory. There are parts of the calls which are inconsistent with what she said in her trial testimony. But the main thing is, the main inconsistency is between what she did not say. At trial, her testimony basically creates the impression that her testimony leads to the conclusion that she is the one who led to Alexander Vasquez getting caught up in this drug deal and led to him getting arrested and led to him being put in this situation. It should have been her there at the drug deal, not Alexander Vasquez. But there's nothing in the calls consistent with her being someone who put an innocent person into this terrible situation. There's nothing in the calls suggesting the idea that...
So it's the silence is your inconsistent statement? I mean, when we're talking about impeaching somebody, for example, with a prior deposition, usually it's a pretty good response to say, well, you didn't ask me. Mm-hmm. And here we're just talking about private conversations between her and her husband, in which are presumably not intended to cover the scope of her knowledge about the circumstances.
And that goes back to her statements about how both defendants are similarly situated in equal trouble.
No, they're both in the MCC, right?
Yes.
Facing federal drug charges.
Yes.
And facing long sentences. They're both in a lot of trouble. There's no doubt about that.
They're both in a lot of trouble. And then it continues on into when she's talking about the plea agreement, the kind of plea that defendants' counsel is urging Perez to try to do. The idea there being that Perez should do a blind plea and should be careful not to implicate Vasquez in any kind of plea agreement with the government. There's nothing there to suggest that because there's nothing
that's
there.
That's counsel, right?
Yes, I mean, but her understanding being that there's nothing there that would suggest the idea that she's saying that finally, now that you're pleading, we can finally tell the truth and finally get Vasquez, let him go for the mistake that I put him in. Again, it's the totality of it all that is inconsistent with her testimony, which would make Vasquez an innocent person at this drug deal. But again, the core of the MCC recordings of why they were omitted was to undermine her credibility in terms of her bias and her incentive to lie. And that was what the district court held, and it was not an abuse of discretion for it to do so, given the evidence before it. Unless the court has further questions, the government will rest on its brief.
Thank you. Ms. Westover, how much time? You've got 4 minutes.
Just real quick, Your Honor. As to 803, the government didn't rely on it, but even if it had, there has to be some intentionality. She would have to be expressing some sort of intentionality for 803 to even work. So I just wanted to point out that it would be the defendant's strong contention that none of this, at least as I could recall, would qualify under 803, just to make sure everybody's clear on that. Another thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is in reference to the factual question regarding whether or not there was discussion in the tapes about Mr. Brindley telling Mr. Vasquez to plead guilty. That was a different section than what the court's referring to, than what counsel for the government referred to. The section that we're talking about, and it is cited specifically in the brief, Mr. Perez, in both our opening and reply brief, Mr. Perez tells Mrs. Perez that Mr. Brindley told Mr. Vasquez that a guilty plea would be a good idea. And then Mr. Perez says, so he's talking about a blind plea too. Are you talking a blind plea would be a good idea? Then Ms. Perez says, so he's talking about a plea too. Yes, he's talking about a plea. That's the part of the recording, and I'm not sure that's 100% accurate, but I think that's pretty close to the wording. Finally, as to the harmlessness of the error and some of the things that the government talked about, I want to make clear there was a split verdict in this case, so this wasn't exactly, and this wasn't the easiest, there wasn't overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt in terms of knowledge. There was evidence that he was there, and certainly the fact that he fled the scene, I'm not going to stand here and say that that was a great fact for us. But it does not by itself prove that he knew what was in the trap compartment.
And he said we got the money, though, didn't he? When Perez said it, and then he repeated it.
I think what happened was Perez, that was after, I don't think he repeated it at all. I don't think that's in the recordings. I think Perez says, we got the money.
Perez was talking to the Diaz.
Diaz.
And said, we've got the money. And he, Vasquez, repeated that. We've got the money, didn't he? Isn't that what it is?
That's not my recollection. I could be wrong. I don't remember that in the transcript. I'm not averring that. I'm saying I don't recall it. And I certainly don't recall it being argued significantly at trial, and I'm sure it wasn't part of the government's argument in the closing.
So if that happened, that's pretty strong evidence, coupled with the fact that he takes off at the Bonneville and runs and just abandons it.
And the
cell phone has a number of calls on it between he and Perez.
And I'm not saying that there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict. What I'm saying is what the government has to establish with harmless error is that the jury would not have convicted in this case if it hadn't been for the prejudicial evidence that came in. And I think given the nature of the prejudice and given that this was, in fact, a split verdict case, I think it's impossible, given this highly prejudicial nature of this evidence, I think it would be impossible to say for sure what the jury would have done. And I think that that's what the government has to establish. The other point I wanted to make, and I think this has been a little bit lost, so I just wanted to make sure that it was cleaned up. We're not saying that the government can't ask questions about motive. We're just saying they couldn't play the tapes this way and offer them for their truth. Certainly, we ask questions about witnesses, cooperating witnesses' motives all the time. So I think that they could do that, and the government seems to want to argue, well, there was evidence of motive here, so these tapes were okay, and the way they were admitted is okay. And I understand the incentive, the desire, the intuition that this type of motive evidence is the type of thing that the government should be able to ask about. It is. They just can't admit these recordings for their truth, and I don't think they could even ask about some of the statements that Mr. Brindley made in the first place. I think that some of the statements that where they asked Mrs. Perez about what Mr. Brindley said, I think some of those statements don't actually establish their motive, her motive. They certainly aren't necessary to establishing her motive, and given the highly, highly prejudicial nature of them, shouldn't have been allowed. And finally, on my list, as to whether or not we requested a smaller, that parts of the recordings be taken out, we did at least on two occasions. Mr. Brindley specifically objected to the statement where he said everybody's going to lose. He said that one was too much. And I believe there was one other statement that he objected to in the last of the recordings specifically, and said that those specifically were too much. There was also, I think, repeatedly he said that it was any statement where he made the prejudice, where he was talking about it was just entirely should have been out anyway. With that, that's my time, unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. And Ms. Westover, you were appointed for your client? Or?
I honestly don't know. I don't handle it.
Okay. Well, our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.